name is Janet Flores, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. And thank you for asking me to lead. Kim called me and asked me. I want to welcome the new people. I didn't get this young man their name over here that said they were new. Who was that? Hey, Joseph. And Marcelo, and Nancy, and Mark, and Teresa, and Mari. Did I miss anybody?
Ashley.
Welcome. I'm glad you're here. I moved to school that you guys are the most important people in the room. I know some old timers don't say that, but I do. I really believe that. And happy birthday, Jessica. I'm glad to be able to be here to share that with you. That's amazing. Well, I'm here today because I've been asked to share, and, you know, I believe that I have to pay things forward. I have a responsibility to carry the message, and the message is the message of the 12 steps, because that, for me, that's the meat and potatoes of this program. You know, I was taught that you share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I'm going to try to do that as briefly as possible. I'm a long-winded talker, so I don't want to talk too much. But I want to open up with telling you, like, if my story was in the book, I'll tell you where it'd be. It'd be in the section that they said they stopped in time. And if you're not familiar with that page, it doesn't have a page number. But it says, among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism through given time. All might have. And so why do men and women like these join AA? You know, when men and women who are more fortunate in that they have never, like, had delirium tremors or gone in hospitals, asylums, jails, you know, why do they come to AA? It says, the stories that are in this chapter, this area, it says, now tell their experience, answer the question. They saw that they became actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. They realized that repeated lack of drinking control when they really wanted control was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that compulsive alcoholism already had them, that complete ruin would be only a question of time. Seeing this danger, they came to AA. They realized that, in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly, no sane man or woman would wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Therefore, the stories in this section, the 17 AA stories, and hundreds of thousands like them, have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up something like this. We didn't wait to hit bottom, because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what happened to me. And you know, I thought I hadn't had any of those things happen to me when I came to the program. So I'm going to just kind of backtrack and tell you how I ended up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking, like, when I was in my teens, like most people. You know, stealing some alcohol from my friend's alcoholic dad, and, you know, throwing up, and, you know, I tried smoking, and I threw up, and I never smoked again. I drank, I threw up, and I drank again. That was a clue right there. You know, I threw up several times, and I still wanted to drink some more, because I basically drank for the effect. I really didn't like the way it tasted. I'm not, you know, I'm not a connoisseur of alcohol. I like what it does to me. And during that time, I was in my teens, I wanted to feel good, you know. And I realize now that the real reason I wanted to feel good was because I didn't feel good. I mean, I was not happy. And I wanted something to make me happy, and alcohol seemed to be able to do that. It did what it was supposed to do. And I wasn't happy because I lived in a remote part of the world in a little town called Shafter. I didn't even live in the town. I lived 3 miles out of town in a little area called the Mexican Colony. And, you know, we didn't have any, my mom didn't drive, and we couldn't go anywhere. We just used to walk around the fields and you know, go back somewhere and drink. You know, that was our pastime. And when my, I was a good, nice, you know, I was that little girl that got on her report card that Janet's a little good little helper. You know, I was like the teacher's pet. I was that girl. And everybody liked me. I used to translate in the office. When I was in second grade, they'd call me to go translate because I guess I was kind of smart. And, you know, I was kind of nerdy. I liked to do things that I wouldn't tell my friends that I liked to do, like go to concerts, listen to Henry Mancini, which is like orchestra music, and wouldn't tell my friends, though, because they'd think I was weird. And but then once alcohol and other things in the 70s, you know, there was always other things, came into effect, I forgot all about that stuff, you know. I changed my appearance. I dropped a bunch of weight. All of a sudden, boys were interested in me, and, you know, it was a whole different scene. You know, we used to wear mini skirts and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and I just was a rebellious kind of person after that. I got rebellious, and my rebellion, though, thank goodness, was interrupted by the civil rights movement, and so I channeled my rebelliousness into fighting for causes instead of fighting against, you know, people or whatever. And then I decided to go to college because they told me, I used to, you know, my mom let me go work out in the fields, and I'm like, oh, hell no, I don't want to do this. And they told me, you know, there's money, financial aid, and there's boys. I'm like, in college? Okay, money and boys, yeah, that's great. And I actually liked school, so I did well in school. And I partied my ass off. I don't know how I did it, but I had big goals, and I wanted to be a like a doctor or something. But then when I found out how much, you know, chemistry and shit I had to take, I'm like, I can't party and do that too, you know. So I lowered my standards. You know, I didn't realize how much alcohol was playing a part in my life. The reason I picked San Diego State as a school to transfer to was because it was near Mexico, where I could go across the border and drink freely without, you know, without impunity and getting in trouble by, you know, police or anything, I thought. And, you know, I could go to clubs and get out at 7 in the morning, you know, go dancing all night. And I was a disco queen. I loved discos back in the 80s. That was the deal, you know. And I thought I was in heaven, you know. I was away from my parents. I was living on my own. But, you know, shit happened to me. You know, I almost got killed because I lived in this little poor side of town. And I got my financial aid check. I don't know how to manage money. I went and bought a huge stereo. Didn't have anything to eat the rest of the month, you know, but I had this huge stereo. I'm blasting it away off the windows and shit. And somebody tried to rob me, and they tried to break in my house. And I come from a Shafter, small little town, to this big city, and I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm telling the boyfriend I picked up really quick because he had a lot of weed all the time, and I told him, somebody keeps knocking at my door and asking, you know, if somebody's here. And he goes, they're casing your house. I go, what does that mean? He goes, they're trying to rob you. I'm like, ah. Sure enough, you know, somebody tried to rob me. Gun went off, and that was my introduction to urban living. And I just, you know, that boyfriend ended up, you know, getting into doing heroin, and I found myself in Tijuana in a flat trying to revive him, and I don't know what happened to my life, you know, just different influences. You know, I was drinking and partying in Tijuana and Ensenada, and I love that Mexican beer, and I finally got to graduate school somehow, and, you know, I didn't do it. You know, I did a lot of, my big motto back then was by any means possible. So, you know, I wasn't all the way honest with all my homework, and, you know, I borrowed stuff. Today, you can't do that. You know, I plagiarized, and I used other people's papers, and I changed my grades on the teacher's book when I was in science because I couldn't pass a class. I mean, I just did all kinds of shady things. Things I'm not proud of having done, but they all came out in my fourth step. And I ended up in graduate school finishing, took all my, four of my classmates to Tijuana, and we proceeded to get super drunk, and I would not let anybody else drive, and I ended up crashing in Tijuana, and I ended up in the Tijuana jail. For like 3 days. It was an adventure. You know, you would think that that would make me stop drinking, right? But all it did was make me stop drinking tequila in Tijuana. I'm like, never going to drink tequila in Tijuana again. Never, you know. I proceeded to drink, and I got out. I got a great job, and that just made it easier to drink because now I had money. I was a student. I really never had money, but now I had, like, a paycheck, and I could buy really nice disco clothes, and you know, I was partying it up, man. I had my own apartment, and my, you know, I had clothes, I had a car, I had, you know, the party girl, parties at my house, and I told that people on that job, you know, this is the kind of attitude they have. They told me that I couldn't do what I was doing with the youth, that I was going to have to stay in the office now, and I said, I don't want to stay in the office. They go, well, that's really why we hired you, but, you know, you started doing all this outreach, and that was great, but we don't need you to do that anymore. I'm like, oh, you know what you can do with this job? You can take this job, shove it up your ass. I don't want this job anymore. And I just walked off the job. First job out of college, you know. I went home to my mom. My mom goes, you never quit a job until you have another job. And I was so cocky and, you know, like, oh, don't worry. I'll get another job like that, you know. The next week, somebody called me, and they asked me if I wanted to be a teacher. I'm like, sure. Be a teacher. Never been a teacher before. I'll be a teacher. And I got to work with these kids that got kicked out of continuation school. Half of them couldn't read, so I was teaching them like basic reading and like arithmetic. And it was a really cool job because I got to go to their house or meet them at the center or meet them at the park or wherever. It was like independent study type thing. And you know, I was like 23 and I looked like them basically back then. And I got to wear leisure clothes, you know, torn up jeans. They wanted me to identify with the students. And half the time I was calling them, I have a hangover. And they, oh, me too. You think we could just meet like later on today? Yeah, you know. They thought I was really cool. You know? Unfortunately, the people who were paying me a salary after 2.5 years didn't think I was that cool. And they pink slipped me. I'm like, oh, what am I going to do now, you know? I live off my savings. And I had another boyfriend by then who also liked heroin. And I don't know why people like heroin are attracted to me, but it seems like they are. And, you know, we're partying it up. I'm not doing any of that. I'm just drinking. And I'm having a great time. And but it comes time I have to find a job. So I go look for a job. You know, I'm running out of money. And he was like working the union, never worked, and whatever. Finally, I go, I got to go find a job. So I went to go look for a job, and, you know, I had my disco clothes on, and I used to have this big hair like that, and pink eyeshadow, and big strappy shoes, and I would go to these interviews, and they wouldn't hire me. I don't know why, you know? I don't know why. I had all the education. I had volunteered everywhere, and, you know, I had this reputation for being a radical, so I wouldn't, you know, Bakersfield's not kind of, they're kind of conservative there. And I couldn't get a job. Finally, I just said, you know, I'm just going to take anything. Where's a newspaper? You know, I was playing like Cal State Bakersfield, Bakersfield College, and they, you know, I was bilingual, I had a master's degree, you know, had this great job record, right? No, they wouldn't hire me. Well, I said, I'm going to lower my standards. I found this article and said they needed a bilingual alcoholism counselor. Why? I don't know that much about alcoholism. I went to the interview, and I tell them, you know, I don't know that much about alcoholism, but I'm a quick study. Send me to some training, and I know how to do counseling, and I'm bilingual. They needed a bilingual person. Have a master's degree, you know. They go, okay. They hired me, and they sent me to San Diego for all this training on alcoholism and social models, and they said, the other thing you have to do for training is you have to go to A meetings. I'm like, oh, okay, what's that? And I had remembered that I had been to an A meeting with that boyfriend that I had to end up breaking up with, but the boyfriend that I had, when I first met him, the one that was doing heroin, he wasn't doing heroin when I first met him, but he told me he had a drunk driving, and he couldn't go out with me that night because he had to go to a meeting. And he goes, unless you want to go with me. And I said, okay, I'll go with you. So I went with him, and it was in this place called Oildale. Anybody familiar with Oildale? And you got to, like, we walked up to this, it was like an old firehouse, and the lights were off, you know. Anybody here? He goes, yeah, there's people in there. we were late. We go in and you have to step down, almost fell. And they were having a candlelight meeting. And it looked like, like Chucky. Like they had like a little candle. I'm so-and-so. And they'd say something. And I don't remember what they said. And then they all clap. And I'm like, what is that? That's weird. It's kind of cool, though. Because, I'm a counselor, so touchy-feely, talking about feelings and stuff. I like that stuff. So I left, like, that's kind of a weird thing. He goes, yeah, come on, let's go. We only got a 12-pack, What was that? You have to go to these every week? So that was my only recollection of what AA was. And so I went to these meetings, and I would say, hi, I'm Janet, and I'm observing. I'm a visiting or whatever, And I would listen because I'm a good listener. I'm trained to listen. And I was like going, shit, I've done that? Oh, my God. And then it became a secret. Oh, my God, I can't tell these people I've done that. That's happened to me. Oh, I felt like that. And the more I went to these meetings, the more I said, hell, I better quit drinking. I'm going to end up like these people. I'm going to end up like these people. Heaven forbid, Heaven forbid I should have to come to these damn meetings all the rest of my life, And when I was in school, I used to think that I had everything. So I was a psych major. So I used to, read everything but mental illness. And every time I would read something, I thought I had it. I think I have, schizophrenia, and I'd read something, I think I'm depressive, whatever. And so I thought, I'm just doing that again. I think I'm an alcoholic. I'm not, But, I was still partying, and time went on, and I was drinking. I tried to come back a little bit. But I used to go dancing and drinking, and one day the board of directors came in, and they said, hey, Janet, the clients are starting to say that they see you at the club and that you're kind of drunk. I'm like, oh, they're exaggerating. And they said, do you think maybe you can, not drink? I'm like, well, of course I can not drink, I didn't tell them I couldn't stop drinking. And I really did believe I could stop drinking. So I ended up drinking at home only because I stopped going out because I didn't want to lose my job. And people would say, how much do you drink? I said, I only have one drink a night. I don't know if you're familiar with Mai Tai glasses. Mm-hmm. Well, Mai Tai glasses have the same shape as Black Russian glasses. Black Russian, the black drink, Black Russian. It's the same glass, except it's miniature. This one's miniature, and that one's big. So I would make me a Black Russian in a Mai Tai glass, because it looked the same kind of glass. And then I said, how much do you drink? I could just have one drink a night, And I used to wear suits to work, and I remember I'd wake up in the morning, like, in my suit, my feet up on the coffee table, because I lived alone by this point. I had broke up with the guy doing heroin, because I asked him, I said, you could get a recovery, and you can get sober, and I can help you. I work in that field, I can help you. And he said, you mean stay with you and not use or keep using? I said, yeah. He goes, bye. That's not very nice. I see where my importance was. So now I'm living alone, and I'm looking at myself a lot because I had to read all this literature, all of it, and on the book. And I love to study, so I studied the book. And I told this guy, one old timer, I said, I really like those steps, and I like the book and everything. Can I do those even if I'm not an alcoholic? And he said, he opens up the 12 by 12, and I forgot what page it is, but he says, look, it says right here, we think that anybody could, do well by doing these steps. And I said, oh, then I can do them. He goes, yeah. The only thing is you have to have, like, a clear mind. Do you drink? I go, oh, I'm just a weekend drinker. And I just drink socially. And he goes, well, then it won't be a problem for you because you shouldn't drink, like, for 30 days when you do this. He already knew I was an alcoholic. I don't know how he knew, but he knew. And I said, okay, yeah, sure. So I'd go out with my friends and I'd say, I'm only drinking water today because I'm going to do these steps for my job and I can't drink. And they go, okay. So I start off drinking water. And then, about an hour into it, I'm like, fuck this shit. That's my job, And I wouldn't not drink, Then I started getting worried. I'm like, what's going on? I said I wasn't going to drink, and then I drink. And then the more I did work in that field, and then I ended up like reading so much that I started thinking, you know what, this is, I was working in the Hispanic community, and I started realizing that this is really hurting my community. It's killing my, you know, it's killing my people. And, you know, I'm going to stop drinking. I decided I was going to stop drinking. But I didn't want to go as far as saying as an alcoholic. I'm going to start drinking on my own. That didn't work. I mean, I could stop. I could stop for a considerable amount of time, like maybe 3 months, you know. And I got this boyfriend, and he didn't drink. He was a liquor distributor, but he didn't drink, and he lived in L.A. And so we'd take turns seeing each other. I was over there, and one day he said, you know, I had not drank for 3 months. I was real proud of myself. And he says, I got this bottle of Häagen-Dazs liqueur for your sister. Because my sister, she's not an alcoholic, you know. And she rarely drank. And he goes, see how she likes it. I heard they say it tastes like ice cream. I go, okay, I'll give it to her. I'll give it to her. And I did. I was planning on giving it to her, you know. I put it in my bag. And then he goes, oh, you know what? I didn't tell you, but my mom's coming from El Salvador. And I said, oh, you want to make some Mexican food for you or something? And he goes, no, well, you know, I was kind of hoping to spend some time with her. And I was maybe thinking you might go home today. And I went, oh, sure. Okay, you know, and I got my shit, and he goes, you don't have to leave right now. I go, no, I'll just go right now, you know. I mean, hell, I've been dating him for like 2 months. I mean, I thought he could meet his mother, you know, but no. And so I'm driving home, and I like, just like that guy in the book, that mental twist, you know, I forgot the guy's name in the book, but the one that goes to have a sandwich.
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm driving. I get to Gorman. I get off. I'm going to get some coffee. I walk into Denny's, and I go, hey, can I have a cup of ice? A big, tall one. Yeah. You know? I didn't even know where that came from. I really did go in there to have a cup of coffee, but something happened between the time I said coffee and ice, you know? And I got in the car, and I untwisted that Häagen-Dazs liqueur, and I poured it in that glass, and I thought, wow, it does taste like ice cream. Oh, this is probably not even liquor, you know? I'm drinking it. And then as soon as I start getting a little buzz, I go, yeah, what the hell am I, chopped liver? I can't meet his mom. You know, I'm mad. I'm mad, but I don't ever show that I'm mad because I'm passive aggressive, you know. And so I'm not the kind of person that's that to his face. I'll say like, oh, okay, no, oh yeah, I'll go home. But then I'm seething and I'm angry and it's like going on in my head. And alcohol's the way I take care of that, I guess. I realize that. I didn't know that before. And so I get there and then I'm driving and I'm like, oh, you know what? I think there's the club's open tonight, and I think it's Easter, and I think Louie's playing there, and I think I'm just gonna go there. And as I'm thinking, and I look in the mirror, and I see cop lights. And all of a sudden, I used to say I'm atheist, but all of a sudden I got religious in that moment. You know, I'm like, God, please no. And the reason I was so scared was because the week before, on the front page of the Bakersfield Californian, the director of social services had gotten busted for shoplifting. And they put her picture in the headlines and everything. And I'm already, you know, my ego's so big. I'm like, oh, shit. They're going to put a picture of me. And it's going to say, director of alcohol, outpatient alcoholism. I was a director by then. Director of alcoholism, outpatient program, caught drunk driving. And I was, you know, I had nothing to lose, you know, except my career. I didn't used to identify with people in the program when they say they lost their husband and their house and their job. And I couldn't identify with that because I hadn't lost any of that stuff. But I realized I hadn't lost any of that stuff because I never got any of that stuff. You know, I never wanted to have kids because they would get in my way. You know, they would get in my way of my partying. I remember telling an old-timer, he goes, you don't have any kids? I said, no, I'm not going to be that kind of girl that takes her kids and puts them in a corner and while the party's going on. I don't like that. And he goes, have you ever considered you could have kids and stay home? I'm like, that thought never crossed my mind. I never even thought like that, you know. And I didn't have a husband. I didn't want nobody to tell me what to do. I didn't want to buy a house and have a mortgage and be stuck in one area. I wanted to be able to move. I wanted to move. And I didn't have any of that stuff, you know. And I was 31. And I just, you know, most of the people that I knew already had kids and houses and careers. And, you know, all I did have was my career. And I saw it going down the drain when I saw those lights. And that was my bottom. That was my, almost my bottom. Almost my bottom. It was getting me to that bottom, or my bottom was coming up. I prayed that prayer, and that cop was pulling out after me because he kept going, you know. Cruel joke, God, cruel joke, you know. But it shook me up, and it woke me up a little bit. Not all the way, because as soon as I got home, I cleaned my house immaculate, and I had this desk, and I had a little light on it. And I guess for work, I had planned to read that pamphlet, A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic. Because when I opened the door, the light was shining on that pamphlet. And there it was, A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic. So I sat there all buzzed, reading it. I'm a fucking alcoholic. You know, I finally threw in the towel, you know. And then I said, and if today's going to be my last drink, I better go to the club and have some more. So I went to the club, and I remember it was going to be Easter because they had a big bunny outside, and he gave me one of those plastic eggs that kind of open up, and they were giving those away, and then I opened mine up, and it said, 2 free drinks. Now, I had, between the time I left home and went to the club, I decided I wasn't going to drink anymore. They gave me the thing, and I'm like, shit, 2 free drinks. And then I said, no, I'm not going to drink. And I sat down at the bar, and I ordered water. Because my friend's band was playing, so I was listening to the band. And then this guy sat next to me, and he's going about to open his egg. I go, what did you get? He goes, oh, I got $25. And I go, that should have been mine. You can have this one. It has 2 free drinks, and I don't drink. He goes, no, it's okay. I'll keep my $25. I go, well, here, you can have those 2 drinks. He goes, oh, okay, thanks. And I was all pissed off. I was all pissed off because I couldn't drink. And I was so pissed off, I just ordered a drink and paid for it. The confusion, you know, the mental twist, you know, the mental twist. And so I you know, that was my last drink. The next day I went to my mom's, and I told her I was not going to drink anymore because she looked at me on my way out. She could probably tell I had a hangover, and she looked at me with her sad eyes, and she said, please don't drink today. And I told her, I'm not, Mom. I'm not going to drink anymore. And I went to a meeting, and I said I was an alcoholic. It was a Sunday, too, and I'll never forget that because I felt the freedom, you know, that I didn't have to try to keep trying to stop drinking on my own. I immediately, because I had read the book, and so, you know, I was out there trying to stop drinking with all that information, and it didn't work, you know, it didn't work. I was trying to stay sober out of fear, and then I was trying to stay sober out of knowledge first of everything I had learned. That didn't work. And then I got afraid. That didn't work. And so I knew that I had to come to AA. And I started working the steps immediately because I kept telling people how terrible I felt. And they said, well, that's because you're dry. You know, you're not drinking, but you haven't done anything to help yourself. And so I began to work the steps on my own, of course, at first. And, because I'm so smart, you know. I'm so smart. I know how to read. And then I was telling this guy, I still feel shitty. And he said, come on, I'm going to help you do these steps. And did you do them before? I go, yeah, I did them right there. He goes, off the wall? And I go, yeah. He goes, that's the way they came out, off the wall. So he sat me down, and I went to my house, and he had me, you know, look at the first, second, and third step. And, you know, I was done. I was done and I really didn't have a concept of a higher power. And he said, well, you know, all you need is a little bit of mustard seed of faith. And he said, so can you muster that up? I'm like, yeah. I mean, I used to be a Catholic, and, you know, somewhere I prayed that day. He goes, okay, well, that should be enough for right now. And he had me make a list of all the people that harmed me, that I thought harmed me. After I made the list, he had me go back through that list and put the wrongs they had done. After I did that, He had me go back and put, what did it affect? You know, my self-esteem, my pride. What was it that was being affected by that? And then after that, he had me go to a page in the book, which I do with all my sponsees when they haven't done their steps yet, is go back and look at each person and ask God to give me the patience and tolerance to look at them as sick people and to forgive them. And once I did that, then he had me, he goes, okay, now the hard part. Let's go back and see what your part was in it. And he explained to me that I was going to do that because I was going to, it was like, he said, it's like when you clean out your closet or your refrigerator or something and you take out all the shit that don't, you know, it's outdated, doesn't work anymore, it's no good. Because all these things that don't serve you, you're going to get rid of, you're going to find out, wait, we're going to get rid of those things. First, you have to discover what they are, and this is how we do it. And I came up with all kinds of words because I like words and, you know, rationalizing and everything. But at the final conclusion, you know, just was, I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief, you know. And all the pretty words that go with that, I had them. But, you know, they all come down to liar, cheat, and thief. And I was able to tell him a lot. Because he was a man, I couldn't tell him some of the stuff. So I got a woman sponsor after that, and I was able to tell her a little bit more of the stuff because I had a lot of guilt and shame. And it wasn't quite enough. So I wouldn't suggest that you keep anything out of your fifth step. But if you do, it's not the end of the world. I finally ended up moving to San Luis Obispo and decided I really needed to tell a priest or somebody this final thing that I wanted to take to my grave. And when I go to tell the priest, I'm like, hey, Father, it's been, 20 years since my last confession. And I'm a member of AA. And I start telling him, and he goes, and I go, I have this one thing I never told anybody. I thought I could confess it. And he pulls back the curtain, and he goes, I'm a friend of Bill W.'s, too. I told him more. It's kind of like I had to do it in pieces. I told him, more. And he ended up becoming a good friend of mine. And so I still hadn't said everything. I got another woman sponsor in the area, and I was able to tell her. She said, is that all? She said, you need to let yourself off the hook, and you need to forgive yourself, One thing that priest did do, he helped me because I told him that I had never made amends to a priest that I had cussed out. I cussed out a priest. I cussed out a police officer. And I told the priest, that the guy had died before I got to make amends to him. And he says, well, don't worry about that, Janet. He goes, he forgave you the moment it came out of your mouth. I go, really? He goes, yeah, because that's what priests do. I'm like, oh, thank you. I was living with all that guilt. But I came to this program with a lot of guilt. A lot of guilt and shame. I hadn't lost a lot of material things or husbands or whatever. But what I did lose was my self-respect. I lost my self-respect. I lost my self-esteem. I had a lot of guilt and shame. Shame, but I learned the difference between shame and guilt here. Shame is when you think you're bad. And guilt is when you believe what you did was bad. I always thought that I was bad. And I learned from that last sponsor that I had, that I did that last fifth step with, that I'm a child of God, and that he doesn't make any junk, and that I'm not bad, that I've done things that may be considered bad, but that I'm not a bad, I'm not a bad seed, I'm not evil. And when I walked in here, that was one of the things that I needed to hear, that I wasn't here to, that I wasn't a bad person trying to get good, that I was a sick person getting well. And that this was going to be my opportunity to do that, to get well. And through the process of doing the steps and discovering my defects, I was able to learn that I had to, that decision I made in step three, the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, that what that meant was that I was willing to do the rest of the steps. Because that decision could not be carried out just by me making that statement. That decision had to be carried out by doing the rest of the steps. And the way I like to make comparisons so I can understand things, You know, so I understand in step three that when I made a decision, it was kind of like when my ex-husband asked me to marry him. You know, I, you know, reluctantly I said yes. You know, I made the wrong decision, but I made a decision. And it didn't mean that I was married to him, you know. When he got down on his knee and he put that diamond ring in my face and he said, "Do you want to marry me?" And I said, "Yes," it didn't mean that I was married. It meant that I made a commitment, that I made a decision, that I was willing to do that. And that's what step three is for me. It's a decision. But in order to, like, just like to get married, I had to go get a license, a blood test, whatever. I waited a year to make sure it was the right decision. Obviously was not long enough. But, you know, when I did that, I had to do the rest of the steps. And I did them. And when I discovered my defect, that I was a liar, cheat, and a thief, it gave me a way to redirect that and to become different. In order to become different, though, I had to have a spiritual awakening. In order to have a spiritual awakening, I had to change. You know, you can't have a spiritual awakening and still be a liar, cheat, and a thief. This doesn't work. So step six and seven gave me the opportunity to decide if I wanted to keep behaving in the way I behave, you know. If I wanted to keep lying, you know, like my old sponsor used to tell me, you can do anything you want if you're willing to pay the price. You know, if you're willing to carry all that karma around with you, keep lying, keep stealing, keep doing all that shit, you know. And I wasn't willing to do that anymore. I was like, no, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be like that anymore. I don't want to be walking around with my eyes looking down. I want to walk with my head up. And I want to, you know, people to trust me. And I want to be responsible again. And I want, you know, to be honest, and I want all those things. And in order to want those things, I had to stop doing the things that weren't that. So, you know, in step seven, I got to say that prayer where I asked, humbly asked God to take those things away from me. But that didn't mean that, oh, poof, he's going to take it away, you know. That means that I had to learn to act the opposite, because I learned in this program that you don't think your way into right living. You live your way into right thinking. And so I had to behave, and my sponsor said, you have to act as if you're already like that. You know, so I remember the first time, you know, I had this, I don't know if you guys know Dave Christie, but he's in South County. And when I first moved to that area, I was at a meeting, and I had skipped work that day. And he said, oh, do you have a job? And I said, yeah, I work at the college. And he goes, oh, you don't work today? And I go, oh, I called in sick. And he goes, oh, you mean you lied? And I go, well, it's a sick day, but you're not sick. And I go, sick in the head, you know. And he goes, no, I mean, he goes, you're not sick, like really sick, right? And I go, no. He goes, so you lied. I go, yes, okay, I lied. And he goes, do you do that a lot? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you want to learn how not to do that anymore? I go, yeah, I want to learn how not to do that anymore. He goes, stop lying. The fuck is this old man? You know, but he was right. And so the next day, of course, I was late because I'm always late to everything. And I walk in my work, and my boss is sitting like there, and he looks at the clock when I come in. And I look at him, and instead of saying, like, the train got in front of me, or there was a wreck on the 101, or I got a flat tire or something, I just looked at him and I go, I woke up late. And he goes, it happens. I walked in my house going, oh my God, that's all it is? You know, you can get away with shit like that by telling the truth? You know? And that was the start of my, you know, becoming more honest. And I really needed to become more honest with myself too, you know? Because I really, you know, I had done six and seven, but I really didn't start practicing. I mean, I did six and seven, and then I did eight and nine and making amends. And, you know, the hardest one was... to my friend, when I was my childhood friend went with me to San Diego, and we all were roommates, and we got these other roommates that they were from somewhere else, and she was making us mad, you know. She kept bringing her boyfriend over, and we couldn't walk around in our panties or nothing. We had to always get dressed because he was there, and we were like telling her, get him out of here, wait till he was here, and, you know, eating our food, and we're just all getting, and, you know, she really didn't drink that much. She was a weed smoker, and... One day, we just got really drunk, me and the other two girls, and we were just mad. She had her boyfriend there, and we were pissed. So you know what? We decided we were going to put sugar in her gas tank. So we put sugar in her gas tank and screwed up her car. And we took her jewelry. We did some other stuff, stupid juvenile stuff. And then we lost track of her. Well, now I'm sober, and her mom passed away. And I have to go to the funeral, and I have to see her. So I tell her, can I talk to you after the funeral? It's the hardest amends I had to make, you know. And, you know, luckily she just said, it's okay, Janet, just get sober. Just stay sober. I'm so glad you're sober, you know. And I go, I'll give you money for the engine. And she's, oh, don't worry about it. It's all right. And I said, okay, well, one of these days you're going to need some help, and I'm going to help you. She goes, okay, you know. But that was the hardest. I was so embarrassed and so ashamed of that I had even done something like that, you know. And the screwed up thing is I had her jewelry, and then somebody broke in my house and stole the jewelry box. So, I don't know. You know, then I had my brother. He loaned me a car, and I never gave it back to him. It got towed, and I just let it go. Then I had to tell him, remember that car you loaned me? He goes, yeah, what happened to that car? I'm like, it got towed away. Well, why didn't you get it out? I go, I don't know. I'm irresponsible. I was drinking. And I told him, you know, I was hoping he'd say, don't worry about it. And I go, you know, I don't know what that, you think that car is worth like $5,000? He goes, yeah. And I go, well, I'll pay you. He goes, okay. I'm like, no! No! Well, I'm going to have to pay you in payments. You know? But, you know, amends, they're freeing, though, because, you know, you don't have to live with that. I'm afraid to go to his house. He's going to want that money. He's going to have to wear that card back. You know, I could now just walk in there and, you know, give him some money. Every once in a while, give him money. But, you know, that was when, you know, it talks about that, you know, that when we're there, when we finish that, you know, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And it's really true. It's really true. You are, you know, it says we're going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, that we are going to live in the realm of the spirit, and that alcohol is not going to be an issue anymore. And it isn't, you know. It's just something that, I can't quote the book, but it talks about, like, we're like moths to a hot flame, you know. We're like, hell no, I don't want any of that shit, you know. And it's not so much because I'm afraid to drink. It's because I don't want to lose what I have, you know. I love my life, and, you know, it's, I don't need alcohol in my life anymore. Next weekend, next Sunday, actually, I'm going to be 63. And 63 years old, not 63 sober. And, you know, I'm not thinking about, oh, I got to get up, you know, have a big party with the guys of booze and shit. No. I'm thinking about visiting my family and being with the people I love. And it's a whole different way of life, you know, today. You know, this morning I had a remarkable day. I went to a meeting. I got to hang out with Esteban and Keith and some other people, Kim. And we ate breakfast and we laughed and we told war stories, you know. And then I got home and my grandson was there and we cuddled and we watched Moana on TV and, you know, made him some soup. And then I said, take him home now. I got to get ready for a meeting, you know. And, you know, and that's a good day, you know. It doesn't have to have a bunch of excitement, you know. Before, it was like, Sunday, got to go cruising, you know. I got to get, you know, go get my ice chest and, you know, get my car all cleaned up so I look good when I'm cruising. And, you know, some days are over. I don't need to do that shit anymore. And today, you know, I try to work these programs in my life on a daily basis. You know, for me, steps 1 through 9, that's like boot camp. That's where you learn how to do the steps, like, one by one, in order, and then you begin to see the value. And you know, that's what, when I was able to act as if I wasn't those things, like, I act as if you're generous, you know? Here, you can have this. I really don't want to do away with it, but you can have it. You know, I'm good at acting. So you can have it, you know. And then to see the person go, wow, you're going to give that to me? That's awesome. And then I was like, whoa, that feels good, you know. I didn't know what it felt like to be, you know, unselfishly giving. I knew what it would be like. I'm going to give you this, but what are you going to give me? You know, what do I get in return? You know, and And I got to experience what it's like to help somebody without something, without getting a pat on the back. Because, you know, I used to love to do things for people. Ever since I was little, I learned, you know, if you do something for somebody, they're going to say you're a good girl. What a good girl, you know. My mom used to cut roses, and I used to take them to my teachers. Big, you know, bunch of the roses, and the teachers would go, oh, my God, come sit up here. Oh, you're such a good student. They loved it, you know. She taught me how to be a kiss-ass, basically. And, you know, I used to do things for people because I wanted something back, and I liked accolades. I used to do things so that people could recognize me, and, you know, that's all ego and selfishness, and I didn't know that, though. I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I did the steps, and then I'm like, do something good for other people. I'm like, oh, that's not going to be a problem for me. And then she goes, but don't tell anybody. Oh, okay. Oh, my God. I wanted, the first thing I did, I wanted to go tell somebody, and I couldn't. You know, and I had to act as if that's the kind of person I was until I started doing that, and then I saw the benefit of it. Then I started seeing when you do something for somebody, and it's not because you want something back. Something happens inside, and you feel so good. You know, I had to learn by doing what it was going to feel like. And then that feel good made me want to do it more. And I became that kind of person. You know, I didn't have to have an accolade. I didn't have to, you know, want my name on that proposal that I wrote. You know, I didn't have to, you know, I could give people ideas. And I had a boss that used to take all my ideas and say they were his. And people would say, aren't you going to tell me you thought of that? And I said, no, it's okay, as long as it gets done. You know, I just want the students to have that. I don't care if my name's on it. And before, though, before, it was like, I would have jammed them up. Be like, how come you didn't put my name on there? You know? And I didn't have to do that now. All kinds of remarkable things begin to happen, you know, because of this program. I got to make amends not only to the people that I had harmed, but I got to make amends to myself. You know, because like I said, when I was a student, you know, I was not that honest, you know, and I cheated on math. I don't know, but you know, to write the answers on my hand and my shoe and, you know, all that because I couldn't do math or I thought I couldn't do math. So I went and took math classes. I took math classes so I could, like, see that I wasn't that stupid and I didn't really need to cheat. You know, I actually passed the classes with B's. And I made amends to myself, you know. I walked through that master's program, that first one back in when I was in my 20s. And, I mean, we used to party with our teachers, you know. So I went back in 2010, and I was going to get a PhD, but my husband decided to divorce me right when I had applied. So I went and got another master's degree in clinical psychology. And a lot of things have changed in 30 years, you know. And so now I'm working on my therapist license, and I have a few more hours to go, and a couple of tests to pass. But you know, when I take those tests today, I don't have any anxiety because I study, I read, you know, and it's not a big deal. I'm not riddled with fear. And I walked in here, I used to be riddled with fear. Everything. I was afraid of everything, you know. And when I started getting sober, I wasn't afraid of dying anymore. I was afraid of living, you know, because I didn't know how to live. I mean, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do life, you know? And this book, it has everything, man. It has all the answers, you know, all of them. It's amazing. Even today, like when I was going to speak, I'm like, what do I do? So I read chapter 12, working with others. What do you do? You know, carry the message. And it tells me exactly what to do. I don't have to walk up here and be afraid or anxious or anything, you know. I think that I can truly say that I've had a spiritual experience. Because I've undergone a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And what does that change involve? What does that mean? It means that you change the way you feel, believe, and the things that you do. That's what you change. I love today. I know what it is to be loved, to be loved and to love, you know. I didn't know how to love myself when I came in here 31 years ago. All of you loved me until I could love myself, you know, because I had self-loathing. I thought that the things I had done were, you know, made me a bad person. And I I had morals, you know, and I crossed all those morals. And today I have a new moral compass, you know, that I've developed with my higher power. I can forgive today, you know. When I came in this program, I met my son's father. He had 16 years of sobriety. I must have had like two. And when my son was 4 days old, he decided to tell me that he had met somebody else and that she was pregnant too. So much for that first giant. You know, I learned to forgive, you know. My husband, 7 years ago, had me serve with divorce papers after being married to me for 14 years. And after I met him, he was a barber. When he filed for divorce, he had a master's degree and a house in Bakersfield and a BMW. And, you know, when I decided to take up with my best friend. And, you know, I have learned to forgive that man. I'm actually grateful and thankful. And looking at things in all negative, you know, looking at things with discord, you know, now today I know how to, I have harmony in my life, you know. I know that when I make a mistake or people make mistakes, that there's some truth in there. I look for the truth instead of the problem. I have so much faith that, you know, I learned to rely on God, not just have faith. You know, they say even the devil has faith. Reliance is something else. I heard in these rooms, you know, it's one thing to have faith that God can push that wheelbarrow across that tightrope. It's another thing to believe it so strongly that you're willing to get in the wheelbarrow and let him push you across that. And, you know, today I have that kind of reliance on my higher power. I have no doubt, you know, that things are always going to be okay. They're always going to be okay, no matter what. I have a lot of hope. I didn't have hope. I walked in here with a lot of despair. You know, today there is no darkness. You know, there's only light. You know, darkness can't extinguish light, but light can light up the dark. And I depend on that. You know, today I have a lot of joy in my life. I was a sad person when I walked in here, you know, confused, didn't know who I was. Today, you know, it's a different story. You know, I have comfort in my life. I work on understanding everybody and everything because I don't want to have resentments and anger. That is, you know, the poison for us, you know. And I don't have to try to be the center of attraction or anything like that. I used to, you know, I used to walk into a party and go, "What's wrong here? Put down those lights and, you know, get everything going, pass out joints and let's get beer and let's get this going, let's start dancing." That used to be me, you know. And today I just walk in the room and I sit down, you know. I don't have to try to get a bunch of attention anymore. Life is so different. Life is so different and it's so awesome. I wanna end with this reading that I love to read because it's in a story. And I started with the reading, I wanna end with the reading. It's in the story called The Keys to the Kingdom. And the guy writing the story can say this better than I can, but it says, he says, or she says, "The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. For me, it's 31 years. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends. And with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. To all of you, I'm truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more loneliness with that awful ache so deep in our heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom." And I really believe that for me, that is so true. You know, to me, this is a life beyond understanding. And I hope that maybe one of you at least have been convinced, you know, that when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And if you're alcoholic, then you're in the right place, because we have the solution. All you have to do is open the door and let it in. Don't walk around with the gift unwrapped. A lot of people do that. They come, they do step 1, 2, and 3. They got the gift, but they don't unwrap it. Unwrap it so you can do the rest of the steps. And then you can do 10, 11, and 12. So today, you know, I pause throughout the day. I meditate. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, meditation is this and that. You know, Joe and Charlie explain meditation really good. They say, you know, during the day when you pause, that's meditation. When you take 3 or 4 deep breaths and, you know, put oxygen to your brain and you just stop. Stop the world. Take some deep breaths. That's meditation. It doesn't have to be this laying down with music and all that. It's very simple. You pause and you relax, you know. Upon awakening, since we pause, we relax, you know, we think about the day, and we ask God to take away our selfishness and our self-centeredness, and then we proceed. And as the day goes by, we stop and we're agitated. And at night, in, you know, step 11, we look at the day and we see where have we done anybody harm or anything. And then we make amends if we have to. We haven't done it. And, you know, it's just a beautiful way of life, you know. And if you just practice it, it's just natural to do that. And when asked to speak, you speak, because that's your responsibility. And I sponsor women. A lot of them are here. And I love it, you know. I love sponsoring women. And, you know, I didn't have a whole bunch of kids, but I've had a bunch of sponsees. And that's kind of my way of paying it forward, you know. So if you're new or relatively new, keep coming back. You know, don't leave before the miracle happens. And we'll be here to love you until you love yourself. Thanks.